My name is Evan Applegate. I'm a cartographer, and on Very Expensive Maps, I talk to better cartographers. This week, you'll hear from Eric Ingram, a painter and illustrator who creates rich maps of nature for publications like Yankee Magazine and Northern Woodlands.
My name is Eric Ingram, and I live in Paonia. And what I do is produce artwork of all kinds of nature, mostly painting these days, but I do love doing design work, and occasionally I will be asked to do a map because you just can't get a map to suit. If you're an editor or you're a designer, it's very hard to get exactly what you want. And that's why I've always gotten interesting map jobs, because I have, you know, this interest in painting and illustration, which is most of my life so far. My art directors have always traditionally believed that I could tackle anything. And when they had some specifics projects, some map, I felt I could easily make it interesting. So just started the ball rolling. I can't say that it was ever advertised as map maker. I just was a sidebar to all the other illustrations I was doing for Yankee Magazine in Dublin, New Hampshire.
Your first style, what was it in?
I tend to be a very realistic draftsman painter. And I would say the ones that have little figures and graphics was a strong device that made my work stand out. For instance, the Total Snowfall of 1888, you see little figures, crashed trains, wrecked boats, you know, all way out of scale, obviously, but they just bring the eye in. And that's where the illustrator in me came really, you know, the strong element in each one of the maps. It's more of a whimsical, fun, informative, but attractive because of these little icons, somewhat believable figures, nothing too cartoony.
And for that 1888 New England snowfall map, how did you create that?
I was illustrating for Yankee back in the 1990s. That's definitely watercolor. I'm unsure as to how the lettering was applied, but most likely it was done on another layer so that things can be edited. But for the most part, I do the background, the whole scene in watercolor on that particular one. And a lot of this is hand-built lettering, and I may have painted everything in there. These days, I just know how many changes can be made, and I don't want to have to adjust the artwork. So I do it on a separate layer.
So you'd paint this, send it to them, they'd photograph it and composite it?
Well, in this particular case, I probably was working on a computer then too, but it looks as if it's all hand lettered. And it's possible that I did that in a separate layer just to make sure the edits were easy enough instead of going back on the original painting.
Was it a similar watercolor process for the Kingdom Heritage Lands map?
It's real watercolor. My idea was to make it look like it was half sketchbook and half perfect maps. You know, I just wanted it to look a little bit more field book oriented. So that's why the watercolor effect was important in that, just being the feel of someone out in the wilderness doing it.
Is the genesis of these maps, an art director says, I need a map, it needs these elements, label these things, and you send a pencil sketch, they approve, and then you do the final ink watercolor?
That order is correct. I'm usually suggesting things that they love. They didn't tell me to put a bird sitting on the box. They didn't tell me to put the links inside the compass. You know, these things come to me to spice it up and make it visually engaging. But in general, I have to start with the nuts and bolts and then see what room I have left over. And it sort of comes to me as I start assembling it. So the art director is involved in my interim thoughts, and then I usually do it in pieces. I can either put it in layers for Photoshop for them, or they can do it later.
So all the compositing is done separately?
Almost every case. You can make a mistake on one thing and it ruins the whole map. So if you can do a call out, a little icon or an illustration to pop in there later, You can always move it, revise it, put a new one in there, and that kind of thing. So it's more of a layered share. I don't know if you're familiar with Dougald Sturmer. I'm very inspired by his calligraphy on this particular one, the Kingdom Heritage. You'll see the extenders, the ends, and the R that goes way swooping. I definitely honor his work. He's not with us anymore, but he was good at making maps as well.
You first get a brief from the art director. Do you have a pile of reference material you pull from, old maps, or a certain style you like to give them?
Well, I usually start with the bare bones mapping that I'm given. I sometimes have to go and find something else to give more of a regional feel. But for the most part, I'm directed. And that's what I appreciate, is when someone has told me exactly what they want. But sometimes I'll embellish and say, are we putting in towns or not? Are we putting in all the rivers or just the major ones? And it usually, these questions answer themselves once you see it start playing out. There's so much information to go in there, so you have to make it readable for the article. You know, the article has some points it's trying to make, and you don't want to confuse the reader.
Do they feed you the geospatial part of it? Here's a general area. I need you to make this hand-drawn.
They usually have the boring version for me, and I have to make it interesting.
That's what the artist is for. Was that a similar process for the bird migration map?
Well, that one was actually kind of hard to do, to try to get that concept across in a map. All these birds were painted separately, and it was all assembled later. But the concept I came up with, after seeing a lot of data as to how these birds migrate, I was able to come up with something that made sense to the viewer. You know, having color-coordinated dots with circles around the birds was something that they commented that they were glad they got me on board for, because they had no idea how to show that. And they made it very interesting to see all those birds larger, trying to fit them into the map in the usual fashion. So it's a matter of figuring out which bird is represented in the dot, but other than that, it's pretty easy to see. I believe that was for Northern Woodlands magazine.
Did you make all these when you were living in New England?
Actually, no. That one I did here in Colorado for them. I've done most of these in New England when I was doing the maps for Yankee, for the Green Witnesses, and Connecticut map. I tried to make each one distinctively different. I really love the Boston map. I just really enjoyed getting three-dimensional about it. The illusion of having it sitting on a desk and like that.
Would you mind telling me about this watershed map with the hot air balloon in the middle? It's such a big landscape.
Yeah, that was a poster. And it was just to show iconographically how water is distributed in dry areas. And it was rather mind-bending to be able to put all those elements in there, but not in scale. It's just meant to be easy to visualize, but it was not a serious attempt at map making or a point that was being made.
It reminds me of those old geography class illustrations. Here's every landform crammed into one impossible landscape.
Yes, that's the job of the illustrator. It's the imagination and the condensing of information can still be readable.
And where is depicted here?
I believe this is a New Mexico kind of a landscape. It's meant to be anywhere in the West, but in general, that's how they divert rivers like that here, so that they become irrigation ditches. But the scale it's almost dreamlike. There's no correlation for scale at all. It just doesn't make sense. But still, you understand what's going on.
Is this watercolor?
Yes.
Is the original 2 feet wide?
20 by 30. You know, might have been done fairly large. But I'm sure that there was some mechanical method that I used to make that blue water so even, because it's not possible with watercolor. So that's possible that's an overlay, just to make sure that blue is strong. So I use Photoshop quite a bit, even though I like everything to be sourced from my own hand. I use it to embellish, clean up, amplify, clarify. It's all necessary for me, because I know it's necessary to be able to be clear when it's reproduced.
Yeah, this is work for hire. It's got to meet spec.
Right. It's not my illustration. As I say, it's theirs. And I have to do what they want and not make it as something I'm sorry about. You know, I always like being behind what I'm working on 100%, but I'm always willing to say, okay, I'll move that. You know, that's not impossible. Let's do it. I've got a reputation as being very easy to work with. I mean, doing this for my entire career, I've learned that people have their ideas and they can also be convinced to do something even better.
Just got to show them.
Yes, right. One of my art directors, I love quoting an art director. He said, well, I'd have to see it. I can only talk about it so much. So I do have to come up with roughs, and then roughs are fairly standard in this business. You don't want to work in one direction too long and not be correct. So you never know where you're going to get a map assignment, but I really like doing them each in a different way.
And how long does it take you to do a big watercolor, like a 20 by 30?
20 hours if it's a large watercolor. I like to be efficient, but I'm known to make things more complicated than they might need to be. You know, I don't want to just knock something out because I built up a reputation as someone detail-oriented, and I love to throw in surprises and still have everything be recognizable as what it's supposed to be. And it's a nice puzzle for me. I'm working on a set of illustrations now that start in sketch form, a page full of my scribbles, and then take those as my notes and develop it. Then I'll make them look like they're made by hand and submit them. And then they'll see that and make their changes, and I'll be halfway there. And I think usually I'm not missing the point by the time I do my first set of rough submissions. But they usually have to scratch your chin over that for a little while and make some changes. And it all moves forward fairly quickly.
And for this world map at the very bottom, was that another editorial commission?
Yes, it was. I think I photoshopped it, then printed the piece of paper, and then destroyed the paper using tea and aging and abuse and that kind of thing to make it look like it was discovered. It was probably a piece of pastel paper. I can just barely see the texture, and ran that through the printer. And it was brand new, and then I did what I could to make it look tea-stained and old. I may not have just done one of these. You know, I may have picked the best, the one that wasn't so destroyed or one that was destroyed enough. You know, it's just basically what I would call fatigued. I had a whole thing about tea staining there for a while. So I was interested in retro artwork most of my life. So I've always been looking back to get inspirations. And I always thought it was cool to have these antiques, or at least be able to replicate antiques. The double glow, circular globe illustration, that was probably hand inked as opposed to running it to the printer.
So you had your original that you stained?
Yeah, I probably stained it after I did the inking. It's only because I know how the paper acts once it's been exposed to water. There's no finish on it, and they can't get those. It's better to destroy it after the fact. I mean, fatigue it with the tea stain. But it's nerve-wracking because, you know, you want to do enough and make it look like tea stain. You want to overdo it. So it's one of those diving, hold your nose, hope for the best.
Hope you don't get too enthusiastic in your vandalism and have to redo it.
Yeah, no kidding.
And since you've depicted so many places and landscapes, is there a particular place that you're drawn to for, I guess, rendering?
I love the coastline. This always amazes me and how much complication there is in that. You've seen the coast of Maine, an incredible amount of detail necessary to portray the coast of Maine. I guess I gravitate toward difficulty. I don't know. Maybe it's my nature. From the beginning, I like complicated things.
And in your non-map works, your landscapes, is there a place that shows up a lot or a motif?
I've been painting in this area for 8 years, which is the western slope of Colorado. And I like to sell my paintings. I found that painting of mountains in this area that people recognize are what I want to paint. And it turns out they're fun and they sell. So I really enjoy creating an illusion. That's what basically points to is I've got the surface plane of the painting, but my job, my goal is to have you believe there is no surface there anymore. You're looking through, you see the dimension, and it's what I call making a painting pop. You close one eye, and your brain is set into making it real mode. And it's a trick I love to show people is when I have a realistic painting in front of them, and I tell them to look through a tiny opening at just the painting with one eye. The brain does the rest. It makes it three-dimensional, even though you only use one eye. It's incredible.
Like I stand in front of your painting, I make a little circle with my eye, occluding everything but the painting surface, and then.
Right. And look at it. You can use a little rectangle opening. I saw that at a museum once. They were handing out these index cards that had little square windows for you to go around and look at the paintings with one eye through that hole. It was Richard Estes, and super realistic. Photorealistic painter. It eliminates the fact that you're looking at a flat surface. Your eye can't tell the difference after it's looking through an isolation of that painting. It's a fun trick.
Was Estes one of your influences for the look you're going for?
I wasn't influenced by his love of detail, but I wasn't influenced by his choice of subjects. Urban, lots of reflections, super complicated. I love complication, don't get me wrong, but I also didn't really like the result of trying to show a street scene reflected in a glass with a mannequin inside, and it just wasn't. I'm not an urban type person, so I love detail, but I wasn't interested in his choice of chrome, glass, brick, whatever. It was just so urban and impressive, but not what I wanted to. Actually, I did know someone who was emulating his work, Tom Blackwell. He's not with us anymore either. He died in the first year of COVID. I wasn't too much. He was about 8 years older than I am, but I got to meet him. He was influenced by Richard Estes. He did mostly chrome on motorcycles and that kind of thing, some cars. It's all very optical. And I was much more of a earthy person than chrome. It's extremely tricky to paint things like that. And that I would have taken it on if someone had said, I want to pay you to do this. And I would say, okay. But in general, for my own, what I call speculative art, when you do a painting to hope to sell it, you want to make sure that you're happy with it in case you're stuck with it.
Was there a specific artist who thought that's the look I'm going for?
I'm influenced by a lot of different artists. And when it comes to what I like about each one of them, it's going to be a different thing about each one. So I guess I'm picking and choosing and filling my quiver with various people's greatest ideas. I'm thinking about my own world of what I see, but I also I'm influenced. I love woodcuts. I mean, that's something I don't do right now, but I still love to study that. And there are people who do visionary art. I'm impressed by how they came up with that idea. But when it comes down to doing what I want to do, it's more or less a melding of what lighting situation I want to portray, what illusion, what composition, what particular area I'm in. And I'm just kind of creating a memory, but I will also want it to be an illusion. It's not going to be a copy of a photograph. A lot of people like to compliment me and say, oh, that looks like a photograph. I grin and bear it, but I know they mean well. But what they actually mean is it looks realistic. And photos are the only term they know for that. But what I like to move well beyond what a camera can do and make it mine. The painting can be an editing of what I've learned from a photo. I learn from photos, you know, they instruct me, but I don't let them lead the way. They're kind of on my side, but I'm moving forward to what I really, really want. And that's an illusion of this spot, this memory, this feeling of actually being there, but in a most of a dreamlike lighting. And I'm just happy to be able to recompose. I'm happy to cut something out that not hap that's not a good spot for it, or it just complicates things. So I'm weaning some of the things out as I'm coming up with my painting.
And do you usually work from photographs or do you do plein air sketching too?
I've tried plein air. I prefer studio painting. My photos are usually 99% usually ones that I've taken. Usually I'll be hired to take someone else's photograph and do my magic with it. But it's not most comfortable thing for me. And I like being the originator. So most of my paintings are because I was there. And then even though I did not sit down, tried it, sit down and paint it on the spot. It's usually midday light, which isn't great. That's one of the complaints I have about plein air painting. You know, I like doing fugitive lighting situations. And that means it's not going to stay long. You know, I want to capture that fleeting lighting situation. You try to get an Alpenglow painting started, it's here, subject has changed in 5 minutes. So in general, it's I'm not that happy with the lighting and the time it takes to come up with a painting on the spot. I've tried it. It's always important to know how to do it, especially knowing how to draw. Extremely important. So if there were people becoming artists and illustrators, the best thing you can do is to exercise the power of your hand-eye coordination, being a good draftsman, a drawer, anything, all things, your favorite things. But it's, you know, I've done it so much in my life, it just becomes very quick. I can conceive of something in my head and have it be on paper within seconds sometimes. I call it tracing my imagination. Then I have to do the research, like what is missing here? Yeah, most of the detail, but at least I've got the concept. That's not going to go away. So that's one of the things if I were a teacher, I would emphasize. Get your idea on paper as fast as possible. And you know, you can always take your time to refine it.
Left to your own devices, would you always maximize precision?
I have always gravitated toward perfection, if you want to put it that way. Looseness is an effect. I appreciate people who can work loosely and have it come together at the end. I like to work the other way. I like to make sure everything's going to come together and then make it look looser. There is a point where I can't, well, whatever I would do would not be noticeable, and that's when I quit. Artists don't finish a painting, they abandon it.
If your next mark would not even be registered to the human eye, that's when you stop.
Yeah, I'm fussing too much. I probably wouldn't even notice that I just made that extra mark. I like to comb over the entire piece with my eye, you know, see if anything's bothering my eye. Is there something not making sense? And can I fix that easily? And that kind of thing. And usually it's a sweeping across with my eye and seeing all the parts that need to be refined. And eventually I'm happy with it.
Are there any artists, living or dead, that you'd like to mention? I always like finding the rabbit hole with people's influences.
I've always enjoyed the look of effortlessness of John Singer Sargent. He was a very accomplished detail person, but he made it look like he was just using casual brush strokes and it happened to look perfect. The backstory is to hit one thing wrong, you'd scrape it off and do it again until it looked like it was fresh and not fussed with. It's a complicated way to work, and I was just inspired by his dedication to making everything look perfect without drilling it into the ground. And I just, I love that. Anyway, that's John Singer Sargent. And I also love Maxfield Parrish. His detail was impeccable. Lighting situations were always dramatic and exciting. And of course, NCYS for composition, dark and light, place for the eye to rest. And Arthur Rackham was a huge influence as far as contrast of beauty and cragginess. There were many other illustrators that caught my eye. I don't make the list too long, but in general, I love retro posters. I like design work. I love woodcuts, particularly by Gustav Bauman. So all these influences swirl around and find a way to come out every once in a while. You never know where you're going to be inspired next. Just keep your eyes open and mind ready to try something new. And that's really what it boils down to for me. I work in the same style over and over. I'm still looking for something new that's going to keep me excited. The fact is, I haven't tried everything, so why go back and rework anything I've already tried? If I can learn something new, I'm open to it, except for learning how to operate an AI machine, whatever you want to call it. I tried that one time, just going to quip on this for a second. You know, my book, Cross Country Cat, has a cat on skis. I had to imagine what a cat with skis was like. There's no photography in this. But I decided to see what this AI producer could come up with. I said, I want a cat skiing on snow. It took, I don't know, its usual time to come up with something, but it had a ski for each of its feet. And it was an interesting test of AI. But I'm starting to get an attitude about it. You work your whole life trying to use your brain as the inspiration device, gather reference and all this stuff. And they're using the power of many people, all the artists, all the people who went to find the artists, and mashing them together into this database or this training, and boom, something comes out. And it's kind of mind-boggling, but it's certainly creating an attitude for the artists that I know. I can imagine how it feels for someone who's made a living being a certain style, and then they use that style as a filter, and you lose out on opportunities, credit, or anything.
All this machine learning derived artwork. You can get a massive pile of mediocrities, but if you want excellence, you need a human eye, human hand. These kind of tools will destroy the low to middle tier art or map making while creating a whole demand for provably human generated nice things. Like an oil painting is a good place to be, honestly.
I think you're right. That's what I always say. Try to get a computer to make an oil painting. It's not going to work. They need just a jet sprayer, the ink printer. Not going to work.
It all loops back to can only give you something that glosses as right. The essential condition of maps is that someone who cared had their eyes on every square millimeter of it, and you can't fake that. The essential quality you need is fastidiousness and human understanding. I'm optimistic for maps specifically because what makes a good map is something that you can't ask a machine to do, and the people who like really high-end maps like them because they're not machine outputs.
Well, I'm trying to stay pure. I don't want to get all influenced or bad-mouthed or anything. I just want to sidestep it at this point.
Let that pass on by. Thanks so much, and have a great week, Eric.
All right, Evan, take care. Thank you.
See Eric's work at ericingram.com, ericingraham. For show notes and bonus content, visit veryexpensivemaps.com. This episode is brought to you by The Map Consultancy, supplier of professional, data-driven maps for your decks, reports, walls, and events. Visit themapconsultancy.com to see what good maps can do for you. I'm Evan Applegate. I'm a cartographer. And you should make your own maps.
No one wants to see dull, ugly maps. If you want to get through to your customers, you need the best cartography money can buy. The Map Consultancy will create maps with your data and your branding, PowerPoint decks, annual reports, conferences and events, your office walls. The Map Consultancy does it all. Visit themapconsultancy.com and get the best maps today.